1937, Samuel Caldwell was the first person arrested for marijuana in the United States. In 2008, the 20 millionth person was arrested for marijuana in the United States. After 71 years of this failed prohibitionist policy,
it's time to say
enough and demand a change. Normal is calling on you to help spread the word, and in doing so, you could win $2,500 in our 2008 Pro Cannabis Law Reform Ad Contest. Just create a 30 or 60 second video or flash animation explaining why we need to end adult marijuana prohibition. Theme ideas, examples from past contests, and the contest rules are all available at normal.org. Just look for the Pro Cannabis Ad Contest banner. You could win your share of $10,000 in prizes, and the grand prize $2,500 winner will be featured in upcoming Normal web and television campaigns. Join our Pro Cannabis Ad Contest today. Deadline for entries is Saturday, November 15th, 2008. It's Wednesday, November 12th, 2008, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about our show at our website, stash.normal.org. And continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. For your professional web design needs, visit redaphid.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Normal Daily Audio Stash. It's Wednesday, hump day, right in the middle of the week, and that means it's time for our cannabis science segment. We're going to be speaking with Dr. Mitch Earlywine about a summit on student drug testing he recently attended. Then we're going to be speaking with Sandy Burbank, who's the director of Mothers Against Misuse and Abuse, an Oregon nonprofit group that fights for medical marijuana patients' rights. There's a situation in Oregon where business leaders are attempting to revoke a lot of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act and try to limit patients' ability to get jobs. So Sandy went to protest, and we'll have her story coming up later in the podcast. And of course, your musical break and your hemp headlines like you'll always expect here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash. Thanks for downloading us and making us one of the most popular marijuana podcasts on the internet. Grind up a nug, cause it's time for your Normal Daily Audio Stash.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 13 states today, and THCF has clinics in 8 of those states. Our doctors help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms such as multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help you obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, California, Colorado, Hawaii, Nevada, Montana, and now Michigan. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our normal daily audio stash, Hemp Headlines. Michigan Medical Marijuana 1 in every county. From the Normal blog. By a huge margin, 3 million votes to 1.79 million votes, Michigan's voters approved a ballot measure legalizing physician-directed medical marijuana, making it America's 13th state to legalize medical marijuana. State medical marijuana laws now cover over 25% of the nation's population. Michigan became the first Midwest state to join this growing green fraternity. A review of the Michigan State Auditor's website and their county-by-county election results proves interesting reading. Medical marijuana won in every single county. All 83 counties in the state of Michigan, urban, suburban, or rural, passed the measure, and by a margin of over a million votes. It had won in farming, logging, mining, and manufacturing counties. Everywhere the question was asked in Michigan on November 4th, the electorate said yes to medical marijuana. In the state's five largest urban counties, the margins were enormous, an eye-popping 2-to-1 vote for marijuana. Medical marijuana received 130,000 more votes in Michigan than even the Obama victory did. Of the 12 states or districts that have put cannabis medicine to a vote since 1996, 11 of them passed medical marijuana, with only South Dakota defeating the measure with a low of 48% support. The other measures passed with votes from 54% to 69%. U.S. Appeals Court hears North Dakota hemp farming case. From the Bemidji Pioneer. St. Paul, Minnesota. A U.S. Appeals Court panel is considering whether North Dakota law trumps federal law when it comes to raising hemp. Two North Dakota farmers want to grow hemp, a close relative to illegal marijuana, but the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration has not granted them permission. The farmers sued to get the permit, but a federal district court threw out their suit. The DEA says federal law takes precedent over state law and it does not allow for hemp production because of its close relationship to marijuana. North Dakota Representative Dave Monson, an Onsnabrock Republican, and Wayne Haig of Ray applied to grow hemp under a North Dakota law, which at the time required a federal permit. The state law has changed, so a federal permit no longer is required, but the farmers say they still want that permit, so they do not face federal legal problems. Federal attorney Melissa Patterson of Washington, D.C. said state law cannot override federal law. The U.S. Constitution gives Congress power to regulate commerce between states, which is the basis Congress used in passing laws regulating marijuana and similar plants. But one of the farmer's lawyers, Joe Sandler, said that is not the question judges should decide. Instead, he said, quote, "The question here is whether the mere existence of a plant can affect interstate commerce," end quote. Monson said hemp would bring $800 an acre revenue, while wheat may make him only $240. The DEA doesn't allow hemp production because of its close relationship to marijuana? Geez, if you shut down the production of non-drug items because of their close relationship to marijuana, there would never be any new video games, reggae records, or Judd Apatow movies. The interstate commerce argument against hemp is so weak. The judge in the case mentions that it would be hard to differentiate between hemp and marijuana. How is it, then, that every other industrialized nation that has both legal hemp and illegal marijuana is able to tell the difference? Now, in the Raich case, the court ruled that medical marijuana grown in California by Californians using only California implements, soil, air, water, fertilizer, which never left California and was used only medically, never commercially, by a California woman obeying California law and never buying, selling, trading, gifting, or even showing the California marijuana to any other person from any other state, was still under the federal government's Commerce Clause power to prohibit because, well, marijuana is marijuana. And it's conceivable that California medical marijuana could become Pennsylvania pot, Rhode Island reefer, or Wisconsin weed. And the court said you don't even have to prove that could happen, or even that it has to be realistically feasible. Just the existence of that hypothetical possibility is enough to invoke the federal government's power to prohibit California medical marijuana because it could impact the national market in marijuana, which, of course, is an illegal underground black market, one that medical marijuana patients are forced to purchase from, therefore making the court's Raich decision tantamount to a market support for weed dealers. And now they're going to use that logic to ban North Dakota hemp? A farmer can't grow a tall, reedy 0.5% THC hemp plant in North Dakota because some guy in Florida might smoke a 6% THC bud from a short, bushy marijuana plant? Somehow, North Dakota hemp farming is going to affect the underground interstate market in marijuana? I get why some people are against social cannabis use. I can even just barely see the reasoning behind those who oppose medical marijuana. But opposing non-drug industrial hemp is sheer madness in a world threatened by global climate change, hunger, deforestation, pollution, and peak oil. All right, everybody, just some quick hits here from the blog at stash.normal.org. We got a question that floated through our inbox that asked, quote, "Is joining normal probable cause for a search warrant?" End quote. Absolutely not. Or, as Normal founder Keith Strop puts it, "The fact that a citizen in the U.S. would elect to exercise their First Amendment right to freely associate with an organization such as Normal does not provide any legally recognizable probable cause that a crime is being committed in their home, and it would not be something that a judge could even consider when deciding whether to issue a search warrant. Belonging to Normal or contributing to Normal is totally irrelevant to the question of probable cause to issue a search warrant. So the answer is no." So, please, join Normal today. Log on to NORML.org and look in the top left corner for the Join Normal link. Now, another quick hit here comes from Jacob Sullum, who was writing in townhall.com about the subject of Barack Obama's upcoming administration and how they would deal with the war on drugs. Sullum writes, "The main danger with Obama is that his history of drug use, instead of making him more open to reform, will make him anxious to show he's tough on drugs. Something like that seems to have happened with Bill Clinton, who bragged about ever-escalating drug war budgets and threatened doctors who recommended marijuana to their patients with jail, trampling the First Amendment in his rush to prove his anti-drug bona fides." Quote, "We are going to continue to find ways within the administration to fight legalization and the notion of legalization," end quote, a key Clinton drug policy advisor said in defense of this unconstitutional policy, which ultimately was overturned by a federal appeals court. Quote, "We're against the message that California's medical marijuana initiative sends to children," end quote. Who was this zealous drug warrior, eager to forcibly suppress the, quote, "notion of legalization," end quote, in the name of protecting children? Rahm Emanuel, Obama's new chief of staff. So, President-elect Obama has Clinton's drug war bulldog Rahm Emanuel as his chief of staff and Joe Mandatory Minimums Biden as his vice president. Have their positions changed in the past 15 years? Will Obama be Jimmy Carter and move us toward a sane policy of federal decriminalization and medical marijuana? Or will he be Bill Clinton and arrest three times more cannabis consumers than his predecessor and unconstitutionally try to squash medical marijuana?
"76% of Americans no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana. And over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and co-workers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORML. My name is Keith Strop, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORML, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.
Who is telling you the truth about marijuana? The government? Scientists? Doctors? Which claims are scientifically valid and which claims are reefer madness? Every Wednesday, we separate the stems of propaganda from the buds of truth with NORML's look at cannabis science. Well, we managed to get ourselves a little bit of a break from our cannabis science with the election last week, but time to get back to books and studying and learn a little bit more about the truth behind cannabis with our good friend, Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Dr. Mitch, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me, Russ.
Hope you had a great week last week with the election and all.
Indeed, it was delightful.
It was a lot of fun. We have a couple of topics we were talking about last week that we weren't able to get on the air because, again, of the election results that we had to cover. But most recently, you attended a random student drug testing seminar. Tell our listeners a little bit about that subject and what you found out.
It was a little bit startling, but the Office of National Drug Control Policy, you know, the Drug Czar's office, has a whole summit devoted to bringing random student drug testing into the high schools. Some of our listeners are familiar with this, but basically anybody who wants to participate in an extracurricular activity would be subject to random student drug testing. So if their number comes up, they have to literally pee in the cup, and then if they test positive, there are various penalties, including potentially having to leave that extracurricular activity. I was pretty flabbergasted by the whole thing. I think people were in the audience uniformly a little freaked out about this whole idea. The presentations were very artfully done. Everyone was clear that, you know, the testing alone is not enough. You really do need to have some kind of treatment, some kind of counseling available, and things along those lines. And they were, you know, quick to point out that it need not be an expensive program or things like that. But there were other aspects of it that kind of disheartened me. For one, some of their legal counsel was quick to say things like, do high school students have a right to privacy? Sure, but that doesn't mean we can't do this. And I felt like the presentation of adolescence as somehow foreign or, you know, different from us paralleled some other things we see in, you know, prejudice research and things along those lines. So it was very, very scary. When I asked questions like, what about data suggesting that this doesn't work, I was uniformly brushed aside, and critiques of those studies came out in, you know, really effusive, energetic language. But then, you know, three speakers later, somebody would present a study that had the same problems supporting random student drug testing, and I, you know, of course, wasn't allowed to comment on that. So I found it a little bit scary. I was really grateful to some representatives from the Drug Policy Alliance who were there, and they have a wonderful second edition version of their pamphlet, Making Sense of Student Drug Testing, Why Educators Are Saying No, and that's on the Safety First website, and something I'd really recommend to folks, particularly if they've got sons and daughters in high school who are subject to this kind of absurd attempt at preventing drug problems.
Well, Dr. Earlywine, I think you were trying to get in the way with facts and reason, and they've already got their minds made up, it sounds like. They're not wanting to hear all of that. With this student drug testing, you mentioned it was for extracurricular activities. We're not talking about just sports activities where there could be an argument about danger, are we?
Unfortunately, no. So someone has, you know, been kicked out of the choir for this kind of thing, or not allowed to participate in the school play as a result of student drug testing. And again, I'm not saying, you know, adolescents should go out and shoot heroin or something like that. I really, you know, I'm behind folks who want to minimize negative consequences of drugs, particularly in adolescents. But I don't feel like this is an efficient, respectful kind of way to go. And unfortunately, the data really don't support this. The one study that they kept mentioning is one of student athletes that came out fairly recently, and actually didn't show any changes in drug use in the past 3 months. And also, these athletes tended to have much more negative attitudes about drug testing and about the efficacy of drug testing and decreasing drug use. The other argument that really didn't get addressed at all is just that, what is the drug that stays in your system the longest? Why, it's cannabis. What drugs tend to go through your system very quickly? Some of the abusable stimulants like methamphetamine or Ritalin or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, nobody seemed to want to address me on this idea that this is in fact forcing students to use drugs with worse negative consequences, even though this would be, you know, maladaptive, a bad thing as far as those things are concerned. And I also, you know, emphasize the idea that alcohol is by far the most rampant high school drug of abuse, and people sort of gave, you know, head nods to testing for alcohol use, but it really just didn't have the same kind of enthusiasm.
Yeah, it almost seems as if they think of alcohol abuse by teenagers in high school as kind of like a rite of passage, and that, you know, boys will be boys or something like that.
It was funny because a lot of these folks seemed like they were ready to have all of us be drug tested. So a guy who runs one of the drug testing companies mentioned that he takes urine screens as part of his job, and that he, you know, requires it of his employees as well. And one of the principals from another school said she thinks that the high school teachers should also be subject to random drug testing. And I thought, you're never going to have another high school teacher ever again in the state of New Jersey. I mean, it was really frightening how these folks seem to think that the use of illicit substances is some sign of bad character, or that you're an evil person,
mm-hmm.
and that we need to jump in on these kids right away. And I just felt like anybody who was willing to look at the negative consequences of drugs, if somebody's grades are falling, if somebody's just doing poorly in general, or if somebody's just having any kind of life troubles, go ahead and intervene, whether their pee has anything in it or not, because odds are high, problems are problems, and this is a great time to respond. And creating this sort of weird police state authoritarian situation that essentially leads kids to, you know, purchase things to try to fool the drug screens, or go to all these efforts to switch drugs to drugs that are worse, is just really going to break down the relationship between adults and teens.
Well, the other maddening thing to me about this is in this drug testing for the kids that are in the extracurricular activities, you know, as far as I can remember back in high school, it wasn't the kids in drama club or French club or the football team necessarily that were the ones that were experiencing drug problems seriously. It was the kids who weren't in the extracurricular activities. What does the research show about kids and extracurricular activities with respect to drug use?
See, that was a haunting thing. So to get the boot from an extracurricular, you're essentially taking people away from this thing that is a buffer against drug problems. But also, the reason that they can only test those students is public schools are essentially mandated. You have to go to school if you're a certain age, and they can't force you to go to school and force you all to be drug tested at random. And people were lamenting this, like, oh, darn, we ought to be able to test all the kids. And I just felt like, in some sense, this is how we build up these ideas that teens are foreign, teens are from another planet, oh my God, you know, and it turns into this weird us and them situation instead of, hey, we're all one big happy family here, anybody who's having some problems in any domain, let's go ahead and interview now instead of waiting until I find some kind of metabolite in your
urine. What do you think about, I've always speculated a little bit that a lot of this student drug testing is more a training ground to train young people to get used to the idea of not having privacy, so when they get to the workplace, they're less likely to resist workplace drug testing.
I found that frighteningly true. Some of the people I talked to in the audience were basically part of some on-the-job training or just job training programs, and they said the only reason they really want to test is that their graduates are going to go on to these jobs where they'll be tested when they're applying for the job, and they don't want to waste all their time training these people if then they're going to get the boot at the initial drug test. So it's sort of we're only drug testing because they're drug testing. And it just freaks me out that essentially the rationale for student drug testing is now because workplaces drug test. I mean, that's just haunting. And I've, you know, mentioned this before, but there really aren't data suggesting that on-the-job drug testing has increased efficiency, and in some domains, particularly computer programming and things like that, has actually hurt efficiency to conduct these kinds of tests. And the bottom line is, if you want to have a good worker, have a good worker. And if they're doing a poor job, intervene because they're doing a poor job, not because of any kind of behavior they happen to engage in outside of the workplace.
Yeah, that's what we've got to keep advocating for. And for people that are interested in getting involved in fighting back against this, a really good organization to check out is SSDP, the Students for Sensible Drug Policy at SSDP.org. They keep track of, you know, students and student issues with regard to drug testing, and you can get a lot of resources from that website. To take another subject that we were going to talk about, there were some ads that came out from the ONDCP. They've got this this anti-drug campaign they've been on for a while, and 2 weeks before the election, they released a series of print ads. We posted them up on the Stash if you want to take a look at them, particularly the one that was called Become a Burrito Taster, and I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I was so flabbergasted by this, I honestly couldn't figure it out. There's a big sign. It says, Become a Burrito Taster. It's got this sort of Latin-looking guy holding up a burrito, and it's one of those ads that relies on the idea that the more cognitive processing you have, the bigger its impact will be. You don't realize it's an anti-drug ad until you get towards the bottom, and it says things like, you know, there is no such thing as a burrito taster job. We're not trying to be your mom, but there's not a lot of jobs out there for potheads. Well, first and foremost, Kasner's data published over a decade ago suggests that, in fact, folks who use cannabis pay the same amount of taxes, seem to earn comparable amounts, and one subset of his sample, the men, seem to actually smoke more pot the more money they earn.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying smoke pot in order to get a raise. I'm just saying people with a lot of money can probably afford more pot. But this is so flagrantly racist. I mean, a burrito is such obvious Mexican food. I'm sorry. There's no way around this. And this guy has a mustache and dark hair and all that kind of stuff. So it's clearly like this weird Latin feel. And so, I mean, some friends of mine and I were saying, what if they had said, become a matzo ball taster, for example?
Yeah.
I mean, we would see the dramatic racist components of this under those circumstances. And it's supposed to be a joke, but in fact, it ends up being really offensive. And then the idea that they're actually targeting cannabis, which is, you know, by far the least problematic of all the illicit drugs, also seems, if not comical, kind of weep-worthy, because it just simply doesn't have the sort of impact that I would imagine anybody would want to have on negative consequences of drugs. So there we are. We're left with this kind of weird thing. I hope folks would go to this. This is the pushingback.com website, and they have a blog with the Become a Burrito Taster thing, and they're asking for feedback on this, and I'm encouraging folks to go and say, this is really offensive, and I don't think it's going to have any consequences in the direction you'd like it to have.
Yeah, and when I did my post on this and they noted, you know, there's no jobs for potheads out there, I said, you must have forgotten Podcaster for Normal.
Exactly.
There's at least one job for us out there. I'd also pointed out how it's interesting how the drugs are, you know, in talking to the teens in this, you know, pushing back ad campaign, wants to demonize this idea that there's not a lot of jobs for potheads out there. And yet when they take their message to the business leaders and try to get them to do drug testing, they will lament that 75% of all drug users are employed. So, you know, it's like, and considering that, you know, most of the drug users are marijuana smokers, then that's a whole lot of employed marijuana smokers they're trying to scare the businesses with to take up drug testing. So it seems like they want to have it both ways here.
Well, and the thing that came through to me at the summit is they really see this as some kind of characterological flaw. It's not that you're smoking pot, it's that you're the evil person who would decide to smoke pot.
Ah.
And that's just, you know, impossible to even talk to them about rationally. It's really kind of a shame.
Yeah, it sure is. Well, we'll keep fighting against this and trying to educate people one by one and let them know that cannabis users are no different than the rest of society. They just pick a safer intoxicant by many stretches of the evidence here. Dr. Earlywine, thanks again for joining us here and giving us a look at the student drug testing. And we encourage everyone, like you said, check out that pushingback.com and give your comments on the burrito taster.
Have a great day, Russ.
All right, thanks a lot. It's tough talking to kids about marijuana, especially if you might be a parent who dabbled a time or two in your youth. So to help you out, get your copy of Dr. Mitch Earlywine's latest book, A Parent's Guide to Marijuana. Dr. Earlywine is an associate professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany and an expert on the studies concerning marijuana, its effect on health and society, and the methodology behind the statistics. He is a frequent guest here on our daily audio stash. Dr. Earlywine lays it all out without the propaganda and scare tactics that parents know won't work with teenagers. He presents a rational understanding of cannabis, what it is and what it isn't, and why kids shouldn't be using marijuana. You can order today through Amazon.com or check our links at our blog, stash.normal.org. Here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash, we work hard to change our nation's marijuana laws through education and discussion. But we also take time to relax and unwind with an eclectic mix of pod-safe music from many independent artists. We look for music that speaks to the growing truth about cannabis, or music that speaks to broader themes of freedom, liberty, social justice, equality, and protest. To find out more about the artists and download the music you hear on this podcast, just log on to stash.normal.org. And if you'd like to get your music heard by the online cannabis community, just send us an email at stash@normal.org. Time for a little musical break, Stashers. And, well, something's going on with the intertubes. Yeah, Ted Stevens up there in Alaska just fell behind by 3 votes, and I think he's mucking up the interwebs. He probably backed up a big truck to it or something. Anyway, I was going to be playing the musical break song that Less Than Radical Josh came up with for today, but every time I try to download it from the net, it just won't do it. It just won't come. So we're going to dig back into the vaults here and pull out a different musical break for you. This one's from my good friend Chief Greenbud in Nashville, Tennessee, who I was so happy to get to visit the day before Election Day, as a matter of fact, when I was in Nashville. And he's played me a few songs that are coming up off of his new album that's soon to be released. And I guarantee you, as soon as it's released, we'll have him on the Stash to talk about it, and we'll play a few songs off of it. But this one's from his first CD, just self-titled Chief Greenbud album. And considering I was in Tennessee, I figured I'd play this song for you. This one's called Marijuana, Tennessee.
I'm all stressed out from the rat race and the big city life. I take off to a special place I go to all the time. It's an hour outside of Nashville, a mile down Route 16. It's the closest place to heaven I believe I've ever seen. Marijuana, Marijuana, Tennessee. I got a 10-acre lot where I grow my pot, and nobody knows but me. Well, I can roll my own and never leave my home, and all the bud is free. And marijuana, Marijuana, Tennessee. I'm gonna need a pack mule, I'm gonna need a plow, gonna need a few hundred seeds that I can throw in the ground. And with a little luck and water, Mother Nature's helping hand, well, I believe I have more weed than they do in Amsterdam.
Damn.
Marijuana, Marijuana, Tennessee. I got a 10-acre lot where I grow my pot, nobody knows but me. Well, I can roll my own and never leave my home, and all the bud is free. And marijuana, Marijuana, Tennessee. I'm talking about marijuana, Marijuana, Tennessee. I got a 10-acre lot where I grow my pot, and nobody knows but me. Well, I can roll my own and never leave my home, bud is always free. In marijuana, Marijuana, Tennessee. I'm talking about marijuana, Marijuana, Tennessee.
I'm Alan St. Pierre, Executive Director of Normal. Have you heard about the new super pot that's supposedly 20 times more potent than your father's Woodstock weed? Don't believe the hype. marijuana's THC potency has always varied, even in the 60s and 70s. And the drug czar's numbers are full of, well, exaggerations. While no intoxicant is harmless, cannabis is non-toxic and far safer than alcohol. No matter how much you smoke, of whatever potency, you cannot die of a marijuana overdose. Potency is irrelevant anyway. More potent pot just means you smoke less of it, meaning less harmful smoke in your lungs. This is a prime example of harm reduction in action. Besides, the government already allows the prescription of THC pills. Its commercial brand name is Marinol, and it's 100% potent. Meanwhile, the federal government won't allow dying people to use natural marijuana, no matter what the potency. Does this make sense to you? Learn the facts about pot. Visit NORML.org today.
Here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash, we're really excited to see Michigan become the 13th medical marijuana state, and we're excited to see other states taking that leap to legalize the medical use of cannabis for patients that truly need it. But we still have 12 medical marijuana states that are struggling to keep their laws intact, and none so much as the state of Oregon, where business interests have gathered together to try to lobby against the Medical Marijuana Act. Joining me now by telephone from Oregon is Sandy Burbank, who's the director of Mothers Against Misuse and Abuse. You can learn more about them at mamas.org. And Sandy, welcome to the stash.
Well, thank you. Welcome to you too.
Hey, I wonder if you could just give our listeners a little taste of what's going on in the state of Oregon and who these enemies of medical marijuana are and what they're trying to do.
Well, I'd be happy to. This is really all started out of a program of the Oregon Nurses Foundation called the Drug-Free Workplace. And they have now formed the Drug-Free Workplace Legislative Work Group, which is an offshoot of the Work Drug-Free Program of the Oregon Nurses Foundation. They also have backers, which include 10 chambers of commerce and several regional business organizations. MAMA started noticing what was going on with them about a year ago, this past September, when we went to a presentation they were making up in Clatskanie, which is way up over in northwestern Oregon. And when we were there, Dan Harmon, who is the chair of this group, said a lot of things that were half-truths. He would leave out a lot of information. But the main thrust of his talk, even though he kept talking about substance abuse in the workplace and referring to figures in regard to alcohol and other substances such as that, it would always come back to what the real issue they were concerned about was: marijuana use in the workplace, and that they wanted people to be drug tested. Well, the problem, of course, with cannabis in the workplace is that people can use cannabis when they're not at work, be refreshed, not have some of the severe side effects of the pharmaceutical drugs that they have access to, and go into work unimpaired. Yet if they were to take a test, a drug test, standard drug test, they would show that they had the spent metabolites in their system for even up to a month after they'd used it. So obviously drug tests can't show impairment with cannabis in the workplace. Now, Harmon has also, one of his big assertions was that there is no true impairment testing, but that's not true at all. Impairment testing has been around for a long time. It tests for impairment based on any cause, which could be having been up all night with a baby, lack of sleep, worried about a loved one, perhaps the care of an elderly parent, financial stress, all of these kinds of things. And one of the leading causes of impairment in the workplace is actually back pain, which makes sense if you think about it. All of these things cause a person to be less focused and less able to do their job. So we felt that in safety-sensitive jobs, this is definitely an issue. Nobody wants to be at risk when they're at work because people are impaired. But every attempt that we have made to raise the issue of true impairment testing, Harmon just says it doesn't exist. And if people are interested, they can go to our website, which is mamas.org. And we have a flyer that's up there and everything. Mm. Now, so when we tried, a couple of our members tried to go to a forum that they were having in Portland about a year ago in January, and they were not allowed in. Now, part of the problem was they had not pre-registered because we didn't know about it in time to pre-register. But when they were there and said that they were with Mama, they were immediately asked to leave. In fact, they called security right away. And we thought they were really overacting. So when we heard, actually I read an article in the newspaper, and it was still full of the same kind of inaccuracies that we had corrected when we had been at the meeting in Klatskanai after we sat through an hour and a half and raised our hand very politely and waited our turn to speak. And I began to wonder, you know, if they're saying these things and they know what the truth is, then this must be a deliberate attempt to mislead people. And so we decided, three of us from Mama decided that we would go to this presentation they were making in Albany, Oregon, which was sponsored by the Albany Chamber of Commerce. And we paid ahead of time. We indicated that we were not chamber members, and because of that, we were charged an extra $10, so our fee was $20. I live 300 miles away round trip from Albany, so I had to go down the night before. The meeting started at 8:30 in the morning. My daughter had to drive me because I've recently had a stroke and can't drive like that. And when we got to the event, we found that there were a couple of other people there that we knew, Alice Ivany, who is a grandmother, a very, very gentle, friendly woman, who is an amputee due to a industrial accident about 30 years ago. And she was really quite upset when we got there, saying that they had refused her admission, and I couldn't believe it. So also Jim Klar, who is a person who works with a group called Oregon Green Free. He's in late stages of liver disease, and you know, as he says, I'm dying unless I get a transplant. So, you know, we're all close to 60, and I'm 64. I don't know why these people would be afraid of us. When I got to the door, they were very rude and wouldn't really explain things, said that we couldn't come in. Alice was told she was on a list. We can't figure out what kind of list this could be, being as we're not all affiliated with each other, and I didn't even know who else was coming except for the three of us from Mama. And they wanted to give us our money back. They gave me $20, or wanted to, and I said, well, what is this for? I came down here and spent all this time and money to be at this forum, and I've got a receipt for the right to be here. And they said, well, you're trespassing. You have to leave now.
Hmm.
Well, with Alice, I found out after I got back outside that they had given her $10. When she went back in and was trying to explain to them that they owed her another $10, this man actually grabbed her by her amputated arm, pushing against her. It was terrible, Russ. I couldn't believe that this was going on, that this would happen, that they would be so afraid of us that they would act this way. I've never been treated like this before, ever. And having been chair of our county planning commission and having chaired many, many other groups, I'm chair of the advisory committee on medical marijuana, I don't shout out in meetings. I don't tolerate it in the meetings that I run. We were going to go in and respectfully listen, even though we know that it's hard to sit there quietly and listen to somebody lie for so long, and wait till we got the opportunity to raise our hand and say whatever needed to be corrected, like pointing out that there is impairment testing, or pointing out that drug testing doesn't work for cannabis due to the fact that you can't determine impairment. And so we were all kind of in shock and gathered together and all found a place to go and have coffee. They were even writing our license numbers down as we left. I mean,
jeez.
It was just ridiculous. We'd given them our information and our credit card numbers. You know, what I thought, what, are they going to try and run us out of town? Are the police going to become looking for our cars? You know, but we found a nice little coffee shop and sat there and tried to regroup and got everybody's stories, but the more time that passed, the more upset I got. And,
yeah.
It affected me for several days where I was waking up in the middle of the night and couldn't go back to sleep just thinking about it.
Wow.
But it was very clear, actually, from the media that occurred after that, what Harmon's real agenda is. One of the quotes that was in the Corvallis Gazette is this: Dan Harmon, who framed the effort to scale back the law as a moral crusade, that's a quote, talked about how the OMMA says something about the permissiveness in this state, and we've got to stop this permissiveness. It's a very symbolic issue, end quote.
Hmm.
Now, he's just mad at Oregonians. Whatever else they might be mad about, I don't know. But obviously, he's upset because Oregonians have voted to allow medical marijuana in this state. And they are going to do everything they can to shut it down. If you go to our site, you can look at the legislative agenda, and it's very clear that the issues that they're concerned about, like how many ounces a patient could have or how many plants they could have nothing whatsoever to do with impairment in the workplace. So I guess it was worth it to go through this,
yeah,
because it has shown the true nature of this group. And the true nature of this group is to shut the medical marijuana program down. And people can look on our website and look at the different legislators that have been there. Senator Farioli from my own district was at one of them. And they need to be talking to those legislators. People need to be writing letters. Actually, it's better if you can go in person.
That's right. Well, Sandy, thank you so much for standing up for this and keeping an eye on these business leaders that are trying to gut the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. For more information, check out Sandy's website at mamas.org. That's MAMAS.org. And Sandy, thanks for telling us your story today.
Thank you, Russell.
Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.normal.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. We leave you today with another one of our cannabis quotes. This one comes from the Daily Mirror newspaper from 1924. The headline is, quote,
"Marijuana inflames the erotic impulses and leads to revolting sex crimes,"
end quote. You know, it's always funny to look back at those anti-marijuana headlines from the 20s and 30s, but you know, we still have bad headlines today. Today's Edmonton News has a headline that says, "Stoner waiting for sentence." I wonder if the Edmonton News would use any other epithets for minorities. I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for listening to the podcast and downloading us, and tell your friends to visit us at stash.normal.org. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers.